Welcome to Idle Red Hands, a podcast from Japan about gaming and gamer life. And welcome to Idle Red Hands. I'm Chris.
I'm Wayne.
I'm Lyle. I'm trying to rustle up a group of heterosexual guys to see Magic Mike with me.
Which might be kind of hard.
Yeah, you said that before. That's sounds like fun.
Yeah, you want to go?
I suppose, yeah. I don't know. Is it supposed to be a good movie? I don't know anything about it, really.
Actually, it got good reviews. It's the Saturday Night Fever of the 21st century.
What was that one that there was a while back? Full Monty?
Oh, yeah, there's Full Monty, yeah. That was the British one.
Yeah, that was pretty good.
Yeah, it was all right. Yeah. Oh, they're also saying it's similar, maybe is the wrong word, but...
Inspired by?
Not inspired, but it could almost be the sister movie to Boogie Nights.
Sister movie or brother movie?
Brother movie. Maybe brother movie. Better word.
Yeah, that's probably better. Eh?
You got to bro it up if you're looking for some heterosexual guys to go with you.
Why are you looking for heterosexual guys to go with?
Guess whatever. Yeah. Girls too.
Sorry, didn't mean to open that door, but.
I guess I was just trying to say I'm heterosexual. Should have said other heterosexual guys. People that don't know, Magic Mike is the movie about strippers. Oh, male strippers.
Yeah, yeah.
Yet another detail that would be good to add.
Otherwise, you're like, strippers, and you can't get any heterosexual guys to go with you? Yeah, but Chris, what Law's not telling you is he kind of hopes it's a date. Wow, that was worse than usual. All right.
I was gonna retort, oh, I said guys, but then maybe that could still be a date, I guess. I was talking it up among my classmates, see what they're interested.
And?
No takers.
Weird about that, hey.
Did you emphasize the looking for other heterosexual men when you pitched it to them, though?
Or did you forget the trailer?
What do you guys think? Oh, yeah.
I showed them the wallpaper on my phone.
I really want to see how that story unfolds. Peel the layers of this onion. Yeah. I don't know. I think it looks good. It looks like a lot of fun.
I'm sure it will be magic.
You still there, Chris?
I am. I'm just slowly shaking my head back and forth in sorrow about that joke.
Okay, well, now for our next entry, or the next entry in our D&D Next diary. Dear D&D Next, last night I had a magical moment, but Coach this morning just called it nocturnal emissions. That didn't sound so magical. All right, continuing our theme of, we're going to talk about D&D Next magic system.
Not nocturnal emissions.
Although that is a fifth level spell. It's in the advanced playtest rules. It's coming out.
Isn't that in the 3.5 book of erotic fantasy?
Third book of erotic
fantasy. Oh, yeah, that's pretty much what killed the Open D20 license.
I didn't see that.
Oh, you didn't?
How did it kill it when it was still around?
It was like towards the end.
It was one of those things when Wizards said like, oh boy, that wasn't the brightest idea making an open license.
I don't know if it single-handedly killed the license, but it was, yeah, as Chris said, it was kind of one of those things, like, kind of wish we hadn't done that.
All right, well, okay. Well, going back to D&D Next, so everything old is new again, but I suppose a little different. What do you guys think about the magic system that's being presented in D&D Next?
I'm kind of happy that the Vancian magic system came back. I'm a fan of it.
Can I ask why?
It's not a really good reason, but I think nostalgia. It's the magic system I grew up with. It's what I'm most familiar with. And I really like the toolbox wizard, the concept where you just have all these weird kind of spells that, sure, you have some that are direct damage, but others are utility spells that you can just try and figure out how to work them into different situations. I think I had a druid back in a 3E game I played before, and my favorite spell throughout the entire first to 10th level was Wood Shape. I had so much fun playing with that spell. It came useful in so many situations.
I don't think nostalgia is a bad reason to like something. I mean, yeah, it's kind of like all the previous incarnations of D&D, except for 4th, had the Vancian magic system. So I think that's a fine reason.
But you're also saying you like the utility spells.
I do, very much.
Yeah.
It just allows for a lot of creativity in how you play through the game.
You know, I agree. Like, I some of the better moments playing a D&D spellcaster is like using spells like Shrink or Enlarge in an unusual way, as opposed to just casting a big fireball or...
Exactly. I think one of the best we ever had was somebody shrunk a boulder and then threw it at a beholder when it got into the anti-magic ray. It was lots of fun.
That's actually pretty funny. Yeah.
I was trapped in a room until I shrunk the door.
Oh, nice, nice, yeah.
And all you have to do is like shrink it a bit, and then it's no
unstuck,
longer.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, go me.
You the man.
Yeah. So just to clarify, you mean the non-combat spells from sort of 3.5 and earlier editions, as opposed to the quote-unquote utility spells of 4th edition?
Well, the utility spells of 4th edition weren't really all that utilitarian. They were they're still mostly guided towards combat. But they had the rituals in 4E, but they were made so useless by the time required.
Yeah, I remember, like, I was kind of disappointed when I was playing a character in 4E, and I saw this sort of alarm ritual, and I said, oh, that's going to be really cool and really useful, you know, and you as a DM, Chris, you gave it to me. And then I looked, and I'm like, oh, it's only, I have to stay within the radius of this thing, and it's not going to be useful at all. And I don't think we used rituals pretty much at all during our game.
Yeah, pretty much.
Didn't we have that talk to the hand?
That was a class feature.
Oh.
It was still a ritual, technically, but yeah, that was...
Talk to the hand.
Yeah.
It's a fake thing. Listen.
The ritual was the hand of fate. It allows the player just to ask the DM a yes-no question.
Yeah. They do have rituals in D&D Next.
That's right.
Yeah, I looked through the spell list, and it appears, though, that only one spell in the included playtest packet can be cast as a ritual. Because not every spell can be cast as a ritual. Only ones that are noted as being sort of ritual-ready.
So that's a difference. What's another difference with the... this magic system? It's not the exact same as it was from 3.5 or second edition first.
Right.
The cantrips.
Right.
There's technically zero level spells that you get when you begin, but they're actually quite a bit more powerful than zero level spells in previous editions. I think, for example, Magic Missile, which has always been a first level spell, is included in the cantrips. But what makes them special is that the player can cast them over and over and over again without
losing the spell.
What do you think of that?
I love it.
I kind of have mixed feelings. Like, on the one hand, like, it does kind of stink when you're a wizard and you've run out of your daily allotment of spells, and then you feel pretty useless. And the cantrips are essentially the at-will spells of D&D 4th edition. And so they do make you so that your wizard characters are never useless. You know, they can always cast a spell and always do something. I don't know, it makes spell casting a little bit less special, in my opinion. Not in the way that 4E did, because 4E just turned everybody into a wizard, which made everybody feel exactly the same. But I don't know, I kind of liked the wizard having to think about the best time to use their spells. So, and I mean, this still has it, because your big expensive fancy spells are still daily slots. But
I disagree. I think like, I've never felt that a wizard would be improved by, you know, running out. Like, resource allocation is a part of the class, but I think they've kept that. I think they have now just gotten rid of the part to where the wizard has to, at some point in the day, go and hide behind the fighter, and that's it.
Yeah, I agree. I do like that. And I actually like a line in the description of minor spells, because I think it's going to be pretty good in the future, in that they say certain races, backgrounds, and themes also confer minor spells. I think it's going to be good to allow them to give different character types or different races a special flavor that would actually be a very fantastic flavor, as opposed to just saying, oh, you've got this ability.
Absolutely.
And you could even, like, there's a lot they can do with that. They could even shift, like, a first level or second level spell down to a minor spell for a certain race. You saw that in Warhammer Fantasy Battle, where they made the High Elves, they tried to emphasize that they were very powerful magic users, which wasn't coming across in previous editions. So one of the things they did is they can buy magic items more cheaply, and their spells were more powerful in that. And I think this is going to be a good way to, without unbalancing the game, to allow certain races to really emphasize that they are more magically adept than others.
So, for example, if they come out in the future with, like, an Eladrin race or the Drow race, they would have, like, a minor teleport spell for the Eladrin, or what, that fairy fire or darkness as a minor spell for Drow.
Yeah, absolutely. Or you could have a dwarven wizard who actually could have minor spells that are, like, that have to do with stones or underground. And perhaps those are a first level or second level spell, but it's just been downgraded to a minor spell. If playtesting proves that's unbalanced, then they don't have to do it. But I think they've left the door open. I think that's pretty good.
I imagine we'll probably see it more in the case of backgrounds, where somebody could take the background, for example, Seer, and then they might get some kind of clairvoyance spells cheaper as well. Because you're supposed to be able to build your own custom background. At least that's the rumor going around.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, if you know, there's certain schools of magic, and if you want to be a specialist in this, one easy way to give you the feeling that you're a specialist mage in divination, for example, or conjuration, is to take a first level divination or conjuration spell and make it a minor.
That's a great idea, Lau. I hadn't thought of that.
Yeah, that's what stood out. But again, also like what you said, Chris, I like the change, because even though there's not that, I guess, trade-off, you know, when a wizard gets to a really high level, they're going to be more powerful than all the party members, and the trade-off was they kind of sucked for about 10 levels. So you have, I guess, less of that, but sure, I play a first-level wizard, I'm going to have a good time.
Yeah.
Straight away, you know.
Which I definitely agree is important.
I'm glad you agree that having fun is important, Wayne.
Hey, have you ever played one of my games? No. But if they've kind of reduced the overall, I guess, final power level of a wizard, you know, then I can see this, you know, making sense. You know, as you said, Lyle, you kind of don't suck as much in the beginning, but you're not quite as badass at the end.
I wonder if people really want that. I know that was a big complaint, that it was unbalanced in the upper levels. But then when they balanced it, then people complained the other way. I don't know. Do people really want that? Because when you look at the fiction, you know, the Gandalfs and the Merlins, they are more powerful than everybody else around them.
Right.
And I don't know how I feel about balance.
Yeah, and you know, it's worth saying, when we did a review of 4E as well, I think one of the things you mentioned that you liked, Lyle, was that when you start off at first level in 4E, you really do feel like a hero. You're better than the people around you. And in this case, this brings wizards kind of towards that feeling, which I also enjoyed.
Right. And hopefully the fighter as well will feel like that, because I felt that in previous editions, yeah, the fighter and the wizard kind of did not feel like a hero straight away. Like the fighter very much felt like one step above farmhand, even though they're like, hey, write this elaborate background on how you were in all these wars. You know, it's like, what was I fighting with, a hoe? Because like I can't fight anybody else. And then the wizard is like, okay, I'm a dagger prick away from death for a few levels. So, and they're always like, yeah, max out on your constitution because you're going to need it. Yeah. And you're like, oh, you know.
How great was it when you would like roll up hit points? You're like, all right, I'm going to roll that D4. One. Oh,
all come right.
I put myself on the flask. Yeah. So, no, it looks pretty good. It looks pretty good. Yeah. Hey, you know, this is nothing new, but I was looking at like Featherfall, and they were actually just using it as an example for how long it takes you to cast a spell. And they're like, well, some spells though are reactive. Right? Like Featherfall. And you can actually justify that. You can actually build a little background. It's like, well, you know, they realized that the only reason why they would pass on the spell is until they refined it, where you can cast it really, really quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Because walking up to a pit and then casting Featherfall and then jumping into that pit, it was okay, but not that great. But of course, not, you know, probably not worth learning and passing on. But, you know, once you practiced and refined it so you can cast it instantly as you're falling, then it becomes like a really valuable spell.
It's like Darwinian magic. It only got passed on when you fell from a really, really high point with enough time to cast it before you hit the bottom.
Well, I didn't think like wizards died on the pit.
But, well, I guess you could, but I like that image, though.
And, you know.
I was thinking more like that pushed off a mountain.
Let's try this one. Yeah, but then I was thinking, yeah, sure, I guess that's kind of logical, right? But wouldn't the guy who can cast Fireball faster be better, and like somebody see a value in that, and like, yeah, we could spend all this time perfecting Fireball and get bigger and bigger, bigger, bigger ones, but you know, some wizards would have said, yeah, how about like faster and faster ones, just like the gun, you know, you go towards cannon and somebody's like, why don't we go towards machine gun for a bit? This has nothing to do with D&D Next.
It does, because in the Vancian system, I guess those triggers you have to do to fire off the spells in your memory, Fireball just takes longer.
I wonder if you could go like both directions at once and come like up with a machine cannon.
Oh, I thought you were going to say go both directions at once and become the machine Featherfall.
Come on, bring more pits.
I could do this all day.
But there is actually a connection to D&D Next in that one thing I do really like, and I hope they continue, is like kind of the meta magic feats. Yes. Where you could take a spell and you can enlarge it, or you can quicken it. You can actually make it quicker to cast. And I really liked how the wizards in that could customize certain spells. That was very exciting. That was one of my favorite things about playing a wizard, was using those feats to customize my favorite spells.
Yeah, absolutely. I totally agree. That was definitely one of the best parts of 3.5, I think, was when the metamagic feats came out.
Well, one thing that they've said they're going to do with magic in D&D next is, in the past, like in 3.5, as the wizard went up in level, their spell increased in effectiveness without having to spend a higher slot to use it. One thing they may possibly do with magic in D&D next is, no, okay, you're a 9th level wizard. If you want that 9th level fireball, you're going to have to spend a higher, like a 9th level daily slot to cast it.
Mm-hmm.
But one thing they could do is they could say, hey, if you do cast this first level spell at 9th level, here's some options you can choose from as kind of like a bonus.
I think that'd be pretty exciting. I think it would be easy for a player to get their head around, so it wouldn't be that difficult. But it would certainly help players create a more unique character. And everybody likes choice. I you know, when you level up, one of course, the best thing is not really that you're slightly more powerful and all the automatic things, but it's the choices you get to make when you level up. And that's just a choice. Yeah.
I could see like a level cost system for spells, you know, spend one level worth of magic, whatever, to double the size, or spend one level worth of magic to have it last longer. So now that 9th level fireball you've cast is going to be at 7th level worth of damage, but... You know.
Well, that's very similar to what the metamagic feats were. It was like to quicken one, you had to raise it by 4 spell levels. So a quickened fireball, I think, was like level 7 then. But also, it's worth noting that it's always been the case where the higher level you are, the more powerful your magic is. Even in 4E, like when you hit 9th level or 21st level or something, you gained extra dice towards it. But they didn't offer options, which I think is a great idea.
Yeah,
but the other thing is, like, you didn't have to, like, as you leveled up, like, in 4th edition, like, your at-will spell didn't then suddenly become an encounter level.
Yeah, yeah. You know, you're absolutely right, and I think you have some great ideas there with it.
All right, so overall, looking good?
Yeah, the magic system has me really, well, I mean, everything has me really excited. Ooh, shiny! But, yeah, especially the magic system, I'm happy.
Yeah, I'm especially happy with the magic system, yeah.
It's okay. I would like to see lots of spells that could be cast as rituals.
Okay.
That's what I'm hoping I will see in the final version.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm hoping that there are a lot of options.
Yeah.
Just like you're saying.
Okay, we're going to continue the magic theme. So from male strippers to D&D next to the 19th century, the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn. Now, this is the first in our magic series of episodes, and this is where we're going to take a real... ish magic order, or perhaps even a type of magic, and we're going to put a spotlight on it, and then we're going to look at different elements that you can use in your game, and we're going to kind of look at it playing it as it is and playing it as it could be. All right.
Yep.
So to give us just a brief overview, Wayne's going to talk a little bit about the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn.
So the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn was a sort of secret magical society that was formed around the late 19th century, and it's basically become, I guess, sort of the biggest influence in Western occultism. They grew out of the Freemason Lodge, and they were a repository or a kind of collection of all the popular mystical theories of that time period.
Yeah, in the 19th century, mysticism hit big. I suppose you could say it was a reaction to the Industrial Revolution and the Scientific Revolution prior to that. And then people just maybe didn't want things to be explained to them so clearly. So I get esoteric is a key word when we're talking about these type of orders, where there's some sort of secret knowledge that nobody knows except for a select few, and you need to get initiated, and slowly they'll unveil the truth to you. And I think that's pretty key when we're thinking about any of these orders. And the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn acts as kind of a good example of that kind of feeling. I mean, it combined the kind of things that people like Harry Houdini were interested in, all the seances, the Ouija boards, with the Freemasons and the other lodges that were becoming so popular at that time. Yeah.
Yeah, isn't one of their sort of beliefs that, or at least some of them believe that the mystery sort of wasn't knowable to, I almost kind of like mortal people, or wasn't knowable through kind of ordinary or normal thought process. You kind of had to think differently, essentially, to kind of learn this mystery. And these lodges were there, kind of there to teach you how to think that way so you could decipher that mystery.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they were huge into secrecy as well, not letting that mystery out to other people.
Yeah, well, if everybody could think that way or everybody could learn that secret, then it wouldn't really be that special, would it?
Hey. Yeah. Has the internet killed that? Because remember, we were having a little discussion, not a very interesting one, listeners, but about Philadelphia cream cheese. And we're like, where do they come up with that name if there's no cream cheese in Philadelphia? Well, I shouldn't say that there's no
cream cheese. I did not say there's no cream cheese in Philadelphia.
But then all we did was we like, you go on to Google, just put in Philadelphia cream cheese and you get the little history of the company, of Kraft, and how they came up with it.
Wait, you know, actually, that's something because when I was doing research for this episode, I was looking around at for some of the things on the Golden Dawn, and there were a lot of their secret missives and papers and things that are just open source right there on the internet. And some of the web pages actually discuss that about how there's society, because it's still around, apparently. There's still temples around the world that how their secrets are more like open secrets now, that you have to expect to learn how to do this mysticism rather than what the mysticism is.
Well, there's Scientology. I mean, they apparently, there's still secrets that aren't openly known, even though they have people who break away from that group, we'll kindly call them.
Actually, talking about secrecy with it, one of the websites I went to for the Golden Dawn, they had the entire website locked behind a layer of JavaScript. So like I couldn't copy and paste any text out of it. I actually tried to go into the source code, but it was locked out there. Like really, really hard kept to keep the secrets. Or not secrets, but to keep the content.
But you could read it.
You could read it online, but you couldn't copy and paste it.
But you could write it down.
Well, of course, yeah.
And I'm actually kind of glad you brought that up, because that's what I was going to say about still keeping secrets on the internet, Lyle. And like, you think about it, you could just have, if you don't want something to be known to everybody, why not just put it behind like a password, you know? So I can kind of imagine, you know, this little corner of the internet and only people with the password, you know, can log on. And so I don't know. I kind of see it. Yeah, it is. It is easier to find out secrets, and it is easier to find information with the, you know, in the digital age. But you can still do it, I think.
Well, I mean, it's unplanned, but it certainly gets into one of the important things for them, or one of their influences, which what we're going to talk about is like, as you mentioned, Wayne, they influenced a lot of our modern occultism, but they drew from a lot of different influences. One of them being Kabbalah and mysticism, Jewish mysticism, which kind of also then branched off into Christian mysticism. And then there was a Hermetic Kabbalah, which is spelled different with a Q. So Kabbalah, one spelled with a K, one spelled with a C, and one spelled with a Q. But one of the important things about in a Kabbalah is the kind of like numbers and like, for example, the name of God, the 72 letter name of God. So, you know, there's your password. It's 72 letters long or 72 characters long.
Yeah.
Oh, what a cool idea. Yeah. My computer is screwed. What is it, virus? No, smited.
Anti-smite software. But there's actually a few different influences, and it's actually kind of messy. And we should, full disclosure, we actually don't believe any of this. So it's both... it's very interesting, but it is somewhat amusing, is that they collect it from just about everything. Egyptian mythology, or the religion of Egypt, Kabbalah. Another one is Enochian magic or Enochian script. And that was this kind of a language of the angels that was made up by John Dee and Edward Kelly.
That's been translated?
Translated, yeah. Discovered. Yes. They were swingers. Apparently, Edward Kelly convinced John Dee that they should, like, share wives or something like that. Hmm. Yeah.
Hey, once you've been touched by an angel.
they were touched by the angel.
Oh, where did the angel touch you? Just me on this little doll.
There's a Hermeticism, which I suppose the name was a big giveaway there. And Hermeticism kind of combined, again, a type of quasi-religious mysticism that came out of like the Christian faith, combining things like alchemy, theurgy, you know, sort of like this religious magic or magic of the angels. Hmm. Yeah.
So I guess one of the, I guess, more contentious influences were these documents called the Cipher Manuscripts, which, according to the founders of the Golden Dawn, were papers that were given to them that had a code that basically laid out the rituals and the knowledge and the spells that kind of formed, I guess, the building blocks of the magic that they taught in the lodge that they set up.
Yeah, they wrote it. They totally wrote it.
Like you said, the material described in these papers wasn't really all that new. You know, like, people had been kind of practicing or doing this magic or kind of following these, that's what I'm looking for, following these trains of thought for a while now. And the manuscripts kind of didn't really bring anything new. They just kind of laid out this course that people should follow. So that's why I said it's kind of, as we said, it's kind of contentious, and it's like, yeah, I'm pretty sure these guys just wrote it themselves. So.
Yeah.
Well, that's a safe bet, really.
Yeah. But yeah. It's I think it's worth mentioning that, as we said, all three of the founders were kind of Freemasons already, and they're also part of this other sort of esoteric Christian group.
Which one?
The Rosicrucian Society of England.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it's kind of coincidental that, hey, you were part of these two groups, and the stuff in this cipher manuscript, really similar to the stuff in those other two groups.
Well, it's like you said earlier, Lyle. I mean, it's a bunch of guys who are interested in all the different types of mysticism they could get their hands on. It was a big mishmash of all of those different things kind of tied together through this hermeticism and numerology.
Well, when you put it that way, it sounds quite convincing.
Well, I think it's kind of people, I imagine people then almost kind of wanted to be convinced, you know, like you said, it was kind of a reaction from all the science or scientific revolution stuff that was going on at the time.
Well, you know, that's why I think my internet point comes up again, is that this is a time when getting information required going to another location. And that location could have been another country, another continent. So it does help to build up, I guess, the mysticism, the secrecy, the romance. And also it's a lot less verifiable.
Mm.
Yeah, true.
Yeah. And, you know, we're talking about a time where, like, stories of people, like, uncovering things in tombs or whatever. That's really exciting.
I think that works really well for, like, a D&D-style Points of Light campaign, you know, where kind of your average citizen isn't going to leave their hometown, you know. So kind of any news from any sort of faraway land or any kind of, you know, culture or train of thought from anywhere that's not here seems kind of exotic. And as you said, like, you can't verify it, but you just kind of trust people, you know, like whoever brings it. Oh, I've been here. You know, I know how this works.
Yeah.
And I'm kind of going to spread this quasi-religion now. So, and who's to say that guy hasn't been there and hasn't seen these things, you know? Kind of can't verify that information. So.
Well, yeah, hearsay and word of mouth is still a really powerful force in this the era that this was in. And, of course, in a fantasy realm, it would be even more so.
Which is why the thing has to be secret. Why doesn't he know about that? Because he's not part of the secret.
Well, that's the thing. Like, this whole secrecy thing, that's what really intrigued me about him, like, what I would want to play with. Like, I figure if you played some investigators, like, almost in a Call of Cthulhu kind of thing, where you find out about this cult, and the more you research into it, it's just kind of the deeper and deeper it goes, you know? They're into astronomy, and they're into alchemy, and all these other things. It's almost like a never-ending chain of connected things.
Except the chain does end. Cthulhu. Ah!
Right. Or you could do it the other way. I mean, if you played characters who were part of the Golden Dawn, there's so much open that they could do. They're interested in really almost any kind of mysticism. So there's something about some guy who's clairvoyant in West Germany. We want you to go over there and find out about him and try to figure out his secrets. It could be a lot of fun, I reckon.
In West Germany?
I just threw that out there.
Like a Cold War thing?
No, I was just thinking somewhere outside of England, Europe.
Oh, okay.
I could almost see doing that as, like, rival organizations. Not so much the person you're going to find is already in the organization or in this fantasy, you know, Golden Dawn. Mm-hmm. Because if I imagine, kind of, as you said before, Chris, it's sort of like a pyramid thing. You know, people at the top almost kind of know everything, and the people at the bottom know very little. So I don't know if I would really see kind of like, or maybe it's like a, you know, like a rebel who's left. And now they've developed their own thing. But I could see sort of rival organizations doing that.
Yeah, and there were lots of different splinter groups that came off of this. What was it? It was the Alpha et Omega groups and things like that. The French one.
Yeah, I mean, you could play it like a spy game, except if you don't want to do the more traditional political, government, or even corporate spies, then you could do...
Magic spies!
I was building to that, but...
Sorry.
But it doesn't even have to be... it doesn't have to be real magic either. It's just certain... You know, truths about life, or it could just be a complete sham, but you're, you know, but all the orders know that they're all shams, but they wield a certain amount of influence in society because of all these secrets that they hold. So you still got to keep them within your order or you start to lose influence.
Yeah, and you could even have it be vague as to whether it's real or not. I mean, people of the time, they didn't know whether alchemy or not was real. I'm talking about like maybe commoners of time. So go into it with that onset. These guys might actually have magical power. They might not.
Now, we've been talking about the different layers, and or as Wayne said, the pyramid. So they did have an organization. So what was special about their organization? Not necessarily unique, but special.
Oh, their organization was actually three separate orders, and they're kind of under the umbrella of the Golden Dawn. But in actuality, the Golden Dawn was only sort of essentially the lowest level, the first order. And their organization was broken into three orders, and each order kind of had different levels in it. And you kind of ascend up this pyramid, which I think is why it's a good analogy.
Mm-hmm. There was something special about their organization that was different for their time, or special for the time, and that women had equal status.
The other special thing that was at least different from sort of one of the groups that the founders sort of split off from was you didn't have to be Christian to be part of this organization.
Yeah, in fact, the religion wasn't a big part of the organization at all.
Ooh, I might disagree with you there.
Okay.
But I think I don't want to get into a semantics thing. I think what they've done is they took things from the religion.
Oh, yeah, without a doubt they did.
They took a lot of the trappings without perhaps the beliefs.
Yeah, and there still were some of their missives and papers were talking about like members of the order and their relationship with God. But like Wayne said, it wasn't a necessity, and they welcomed people who were Jewish, Christian. Well, really, that's all they had at the time. But
well, okay,
we play both kinds, country and Western here. Some of their influences, as we mentioned, were the Egyptian religion, also Greco-Roman mysticism or mythology, or at least imagery. Mm-hmm. I think that's a better word.
Technically, only the first order was known as the Golden Dawn. The second order was called the Ruby Rose and Cross of Gold. And they kind of taught the first order and essentially ran the organization. And then above those, the third order was known as the Secret Chiefs. It's kind of debatable whether they were actually people or not, or actually real.
I mean, people with superhuman powers? Were they real?
Yeah, kind of. Yeah,
I think what's unclear, at least for me, is whether or not the Third Order necessarily were the Secret Chiefs, or the Third Order knew the Secret Chiefs, therefore felt that entitled them to be the Third Order and therefore able to lord over the other two orders. Because, well, a very famous member of the Order was Aleister Crowley, so people probably know him as the, I don't know, the hedonist or the libertine.
Or goofball.
Goofball. And he went to Algeria and apparently did some sort of Enochian magic where he was able to see some of the secret chiefs and then kind of become one, sort of. Unclear. And then he actually drew a picture of what they look like, and apparently looks like one of those little gray men.
Yeah, the gray aliens, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was actually a little bit confused about myself. We were talking before about how women were allowed in the group. One of the higher level ones, Moina Bergerson Mathers, it said that she was almost head of the Paris group, but she always channeled magical rituals from the secret chiefs. But I wasn't sure if that meant people or like some kind of little gray alien.
One of the founders of the order, he said that they were human, but they had, like his words, superhuman powers. And then Aleister Crowley drew a picture. I mean, really, it's nothing. They didn't exist, but, you know. And I think that's what's a lot of fun, because you can have that contradictory information. You can actually create rivalries within these orders. It's because, no, you know that human who had superhuman powers? Not really a secret chief. Somebody else. You were fooled. Yeah, and you said, no, but I actually saw them. They're not human at all. They look quite different. They come from another planet. So therefore, I'm above you. And if that causes a problem, then you have a splinter group.
Yeah, you say, I can see a secret chief. Oh, yeah, well, how come I can't? Because you're not high enough level. You're not in the second order. You can't see the secret chief. I can. Well, of course, if you go that way, why don't you just say, I am the secret chief? Because who's going to dispute you?
But then you're giving them power because they now know a secret chief.
Yeah, yeah, but they've only they only see that little sliver of you. They haven't seen your
true form.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
Your superhuman form. Yeah. Yeah, this is just my frail body that can't actually do anything.
Let me take off my glasses. Now I'm the secret chief. Yeah. Well, could you send my non-superhuman form? Like, and Superman.
But the equality of women, I thought was particularly good to play on in that to kind of give your secret order power, whatever it is. I mean, it could be racial tensions. You can play on gender inequality, I guess, true racial tensions in that if you have like different races such as elves, dwarves, or things from another planet, then allowing them in and giving them equal status means that you will start to attract all of these people. Because they're going to want at least, you know, 1 hour out of their day where they have that equality. So you can attract quite a lot of talent. It's a good way in a game if you do have, you know, now that we're in the 21st century and you play a game set in the 30s or the 20s or even the 19th century or medieval times and everybody's like, well, I wanted to be fairly realistic, you know, so sorry, you're a woman, you can't do much. You know, your role in society is going to be pretty limited. Sorry, you're black. So it gives you a way around them. You just say, well, in this society, you are equal. But I think it would actually make it even more interesting because you still have the outside society that doesn't give you the equality, but then you have the inside where you can interact with the other players on an equal level.
Yeah, I just thought of something kind of like when you said the outside of the society, yeah. Like, yes, that does definitely mean outside of the secret society, but it would that also apply to members of the secret society who were not currently at the lodge? Because you still kind of do have to function in regular society. So, like, what I mean is, okay, imagine your PC group are all members of the Golden Dawn, right?
Mm-hmm.
And inside the lodge, everybody's equal.
Yes.
What happens when the meeting is over and they leave and they go back out in society? Granted, the players don't have to be, you know, racist, but society is going to expect them to behave a certain way toward certain individuals. And one way or another, they're going to have to conform a little bit.
I'd say even turn it around and reverse it. Put the female characters in the positions of power within the society, within the Golden Dawn. And then on the outside of it, the situation is reversed. How does the PC group handle that?
Could be like Fight Club.
No one talks about the Golden Dawn.
Yeah, but they acknowledge themselves. In fact, like, some of the more powerful members are the low class of society. And maybe that's why they are so powerful within the society, because they're so motivated to excel or ascend somewhere where it is quite open.
I know you hated the books, but they kind of did that in the Wheel of Time a little bit.
I only read the first one.
Yeah, I know. So. Towards the middle of the series, like, there's kind of the dark power, and he has agents, sort of like mortal agents, but you never really knew who they were, except at these meetings where everybody wore a mask. But there's one time where you kind of do find out, okay, oh, this guy is a really high-level official, but the guy who's over him in the secret society is this disgusting, smelly, homeless guy. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of like a good internal monologue about this guy struggling with, I have to take orders from this nobody who's higher than me in this secret society, yet in real society, I wouldn't even look at him. He's nothing.
Right.
It was kind of interesting to read.
No, I think that switch is pretty neat. And there is a lot you can do with that. And that's just something that it doesn't matter if magic or not magic. Because you could put it within any fraternity or sorority. And I mean that in the brotherhood, sisterhood sense. Not the Greek systems. Although you could do it with the Greek systems. And one of the big selling points of each level of the pyramid is that you're going to be exposed to or learn new information. Of course, we're talking about magic in this episode, and their big selling point, or what would separate them from the Freemasons or other more mundane societies, is that they promise to teach you magic.
Yeah, but I mean, as we mentioned, there had all different kinds of magics, astrology and alchemy and geomancy and tarot and numerology and all those different kinds of things.
Yeah, you kind of learn different forms of magic at different levels of the pyramid.
Yeah, so first level would be...
So first level was mostly divination stuff, as Chris said, geomancy, tarot reading, and astrology.
What's geomancy?
Contrary to what I thought it was, it's not the power to control Earth.
That's a pretty powerful thing in the first level. I'm done. I don't need the second order. I can cause earthquakes.
Yeah. Geomancy is a form of divination
yeah.
using Earth, either yeah. by kind of throwing stones or dirt, and they form certain patterns that you can read.
Right.
Yeah, casting the stones kind of thing.
So it does deal with Earth. You just can't make earthquakes.
Yeah.
Which I'm still disappointed about.
That's the other circle.
I guess, and speaking of Earth, at least in the Golden Dawn, the four levels of the First Order did correspond to the four classical elements of Earth, Fire, Air, and Water.
Mm-hmm.
And there was some kind of metaphysical meaning to each of the element, and you kind of had to understand that and what it meant before you were able to move on to the next level.
Right.
Yeah. And then the final level was the spirit level.
Actually, kind of. Like, there was like a fifth level, which was kind of like an intermediate level, which meant you were ready to go on to the second order. It was, they called it kind of like an invisible level. So, I mean, I guess you could kind of say it was the spirit level.
Well, the idea was that everything was based on the tree of life as described by the branching of the tarot cards and Kabbalah. But the final level, the portal, as they called it, wasn't on the tree of life. So that's kind of, it was above or beyond or non-existent within the universe that the Tree of Life described.
Or behind the tarot card?
I guess so, yeah. The Joker card.
So then once you got up to the Second Order, you actually kind of learned, quote-unquote, real magic, which was alchemy, scrying, and astral travel or astral projection, essentially.
Yeah. One good thing about astral travel is you can't verify that. You just kind of go into like a fake coma.
A fake coma. You'd make a great Second Order teacher, wouldn't you?
And then you go into a coma.
No, I'm imagining like you come back from a real raucous party the next day. Okay, today, astral projection. Everybody, head down on the desk, be real quiet, and watch me project. End of like the 4 hours. Oh, hey, did you see that? I'm back. You know?
Guys, that was awesome.
Today. Write some things.
So one of the things that I thought was really cool that they had were the things called the flying rolls. And this wasn't like a food fight thing, but it was these secret messages that they would pass around for each other. And they'd have it was like things that they'd written out, and it included like instructions and spells and things. And they'd put them inside blank envelopes with the stamp upside down as a symbol that it was one of these messages. And they'd pass them around. But some of the ones I was looking at included the different kinds of spells, like the divination and how to do spirit visions and astral travel. And there's one that was saying like, if you're trying to do a divination while under stress, you should make sure to hold your sword in the right hand and hold your wand in the left hand, and that way you could get the best divination when you're under stress. Yeah.
Was it really that secret if you put the stamp upside down?
Yeah, I suppose if people don't know, they'd maybe just assume that it was a mistake.
I suppose, yeah.
But, you know, I reckon, like, seriously, if you're looking to do this kind of secret society and magic thing in your game, go online and check out the flying rolls, because they're just a lot of thoughts that random members wrote down and passed down, so they're all really mysterious and meandering, and they're self-referential. I mean, it's great fodder for a campaign. Just pass a few out to the players, and they'll be poring over them for a while, I reckon.
And then they'll, what, throw you under the bus when they realize, hey, there was nothing in it.
Kick your ass, and it doesn't relate to anything.
That'd make a great start to an adventure.
Yeah, and
they receive an envelope with the upside down stamp or some, whatever you've done in your game.
Yeah.
And then they crack it open, and it's like, hey, now we start. And so it begins again.
Yeah.
If you want to go real hardcore, how about give them that cipher too that it's written in?
Yeah, I suppose that would be cool.
It could also be really frustrating and boring if they don't get it quickly.
There is that downside.
Yeah.
But I do like how they play with languages there. So even though we kind of made fun of the Enochian languages, the language of swinging angels, but just that idea is that they did make up a lot of languages. I mean, when linguistics look at the Enochian languages, they found some stunning parallels between German vocabulary and English syntax. And they're like, well,
Hey, Mr. Yeah. Stender, the human language had to come from somewhere.
Exactly, yeah.
Why not angels?
Well, where did German come from? Exactly.
Angels. Yeah.
Angels do not speak German, I'm sorry.
Oh, they speak proto-German.
Achtung!
Well, how do you know? Have you spoken to an angel?
Nein.
There you go. But actually, I could see, I do like that language idea, because language is one of those skills that kind of gets underutilized in many games.
Yeah.
You know, it's just kind of, oh, it's assumed everybody speaks common, so everybody can speak to one another and get along, you know?
I'm going
to
agree, like, things like can'ts, you know, like, thieves have these, like, special code words, or people have, like in Dune, where they have, a battle language, and I thought that was really cool, like, each house has its own battle language, so they can communicate without the other side knowing.
Yeah, and the symbology that we had in the vampire campaign was very similar to that, and that worked out well.
Oh, yeah, if people want to read more on that, that's in Damnation City, which is a great resource. And just to give a little bit more on that, it's how the different clans or also the different covenants communicate with each other. For example, graffiti. And I thought you guys did a really good job, because I said to you, you guys come up with your own codes, your own symbology. Just tell me what it is. And you mind sharing what you guys did?
Well, my guy was a detective, so he was kind of part of the security forces. So we communicated through police reports.
Oh, really? Okay.
I suppose I never told you about that, huh, Wayne?
Well, not only police reports, but police like scanner, like
that's what I meant, like over the police radio. Yeah.
Oh. Well, cool. Yeah. Since my guy was Dave, I figured they're kind of like artistic, and I said, okay, it's going to be the juxtaposition of color and pattern are mm-hmm. going to convey message. So, yeah. You know, red on white or red and white with check will mean this thing. And it would get worked into graffiti or signs, yeah.
But you also were able to mark who you owned.
Oh, so yeah.
People who watch True Blood, great show, by the way, you hear them a lot like, she's mine or he's mine. They're claiming these humans. But I think you had a good idea on how you can signify that you've claimed certain humans.
Yeah, it was either going to be like a pendant with this kind of, you know, jewelry, or it was going to be like a tattoo. And then it would symbolize, yeah, this thing or this person is mine.
No. So, yeah, there is a lot you can do with even the mundane stuff. But then, of course, if you want to add these magical elements. And here, I guess, is less exciting because, well, it's just a few divination spells and alchemy, you know, turning stuff into gold, or even the universal solvent was not that exciting.
I've made something that can solve anything. All right, what are you going to do? What are you going to hold it in? I don't know.
Oh.
Like, I do actually kind of think that a secret society like this works good for a class and level system. Like we kind of said in the D&D Next, or in just in D&D, wizards gain levels and get more powerful spells. They never really explain why. They kind of hand wave it away. You know, they just say, oh, and now you know this level spell. Or the GM makes sure to have a spell book with that spell you wanted in that library you just found. But if you use a secret society like this, you kind of have like mentors, or great, you've gone up to the second order. Now someone is going to teach you that fifth level spell. The really good stuff, not the cantrips like, you know, ghost sound and floating disc.
Again, no vampire references, Order of Dracul. That book gives you some good ideas. I mean, it's a secret society. Hey, funny thing about a secret society, everybody knows it's a secret society. Hey. But they have a different types of powers that you, or the status is related to how powerful you can be. But they kind of work it where you have to do certain things in order to gain these powers. So that's interesting. Even if you don't play vampire, or if you play vampire and you don't want to do that, just reading that kind of gives you an idea of how your clan or how your D&D character or your SF character can try to link their progression in points or level and the powers that they get.
Yeah, like it wouldn't even have to be something that kind of happens on screen, quote unquote, right? I mean, it sounds kind of cheesy, but it could be a wizard correspondence course.
It does sound cheesy.
I know. It does sound cheesy, right?
But, well, I mean, if you tie that in with the idea of the flying rolls, you know, one of these days you receive a blank envelope with an upside down stamp and there you go. That's your next spell level.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I was thinking, you know.
Like, along with the instructions of what you have to do.
And tell you how to pick up girls and influence people. I'm going to learn to draw comics.
Yeah.
This spell will appear on your credit card bill.
No, I could just see that you go to the bank and it's like, oh, it says here you have a debt you got to pay off. What? Oh, that's right. My spell came last week. Shoot.
Well, actually, that's a pretty cool idea in itself. I mean, you think about how you're gaining influence in these things and the cult wants something back from you. Maybe one day you go into the bank and you find out that you do owe a lot on your bank account. It's empty. Maybe the cult wants some money from you. So you have to find a way to repay that debt or something along those lines.
On the one hand, that sounds really boring
cheesy.
But on the other hand, that's a nice spin, and there's certain ways you can, especially when people play like Dresden Files or other kind of modern arcana, Shadowrun even, and really just really linking the material and the mystical like that gives it a different flavor.
Absolutely. I love that that secret world genre. Have you guys either ever played Mage, the Ascendancy or something?
Yeah, I played the old one. Wayne has the new one, mm-hmm. So I've looked at that book.
Yeah, I've read through it, but on the list to play.
Yeah, no, I mean, there is a lot of secrecy involved in Mage. For one thing, their big opponents are the technocracy, and I guess the easiest comparison would be Agent Smith and the other Men in Black in The Matrix, and they want to ensure that, you know, kind of technology or science is kind of the dominant thought, because mm-hmm. if magic is the dominant thought, reality shifts. Mm-hmm. And not only do they have to be like kind of secret, like I guess they're right, keep their identity secret. And of course, they have these different traditions where they learn their craft. But even the magic, when they use magic, it creates things called paradox. So you can't really cast a fireball in this world because the dominant reality is this kind of science reality. Mm-hmm. So that's considered too much of a break from reality. So instead of like a fireball, they're like lightning sparks from this downed power line. You know,
gas main rupture.
Yeah, Gathering Rupture. Yeah,
that's the thing that I've heard is a big criticism, is that the game requires a lot of buy-in from the players, because it's not too hard to figure out, oh, there's a gas main underneath them, that's why there's a fireball, and you can really just play with it without any limits. But I hear that if the players really buy in, really try to imagine in detail how they can get these spells to work, then it's supposed to be really good.
Yeah, some of the what they call rotes is where they actually combine, you get these different powers, and you get like dots. If people are familiar with World of Darkness, you always get dots and stuff. So you get dots and these powers, and they give you abilities, but what the exciting thing is combining those to create even more clever abilities. And some of them are like the ability to always have a green light when you're driving, which wouldn't be a radical shift. I mean, it's coincidental. I think that's like time plus maybe time and power, because you're influencing, of course, the timing, but also the lights. But you can do that because it's, on the one hand, it seems very mundane and, yeah, it's a coincidence, you know, always getting the green light. But, it's pretty powerful what you're doing.
Yeah.
And then there's space as well. That's another power. And, of course, time and space. But what if you manipulate time and something else? More so than a buy-in, you need really creative players.
Yeah.
Because I found that the game would, maybe because people didn't want to just go, I disrupt a gas main. And I think that's probably just easy, but you don't always, just like you don't always want to use, tying it back to D&D next, those combat powers, you kind of want the kind of utility powers or the non-combat powers and use them in a clever way. And it was hard to figure out how to do that. So the game would go, just a moment. come back to me.
So, the werewolf is getting closer.
Yeah, and you're like, That's how I found the game went. And that might just say something about my creativity and the creativity of the guys around us. But I mean, definitely bought into it. We were just bought into it maybe too much. And we got really excited about how to combine stuff.
Yeah, I think maybe that would just be the difficult thing. You know, like, okay, yeah. I've cast Fireball 9 times. There's only so many ways I can come up with why there was a fiery explosion there. You know? Like, you've cast main before. It's like, you got a better one? No? All right, then.
That bum there had some particularly bad chili. I don't know.
No, I'm glad you mentioned that, Chris, because that's actually a neat way just to tie it back into actual topic.
Thanks.
Which wasn't new World of Darkness game.
I think we've established that we love the World of Darkness. Is that, you know, you're talking about, you're learning astrology, tarot, geomancy in the First Order. And I think Wayne had a good example. Is like, okay, if you do that in a level system where you just get better and better spells, you know, that's perfect. But here's the thing is, like, you get like almost like spell paths, we'll say, or groupings. So you're adding like, yeah, let's say what you said, Chris, you know, you add like earth, air, water, and fire. And you want to do that because then you can combine fire and earth. And
into what? Captain Planet.
Sorry. No. Because Lyle didn't have heart. That was the last one. And honestly, who wants heart? That was
I've known for a long time that Lyle doesn't have heart.
Snark doesn't cut it.
Earth, fire, air, water, and sarcasm.
Thanks for helping me, like, run with this guy.
Sorry. Please continue.
Oh, yeah, trip.
Was that a bus?
Sorry, so you guys done insulting me?
Yes. Never really, but for now, yes.
Hey, you see where I'm going with this? Like, you're not adding necessarily like spells, you're adding abilities, which then can be combined into different rituals or rotes, whatever you want to call it. Hmm.
Yeah, and I think you could use the actual spells that they had codified in their different papers as kind of pre-made ones to give as samples to the players, or for players who aren't quite as creative.
I do kind of like the fact that, you know, the Golden Dawn did have the four classical elements tied to those four levels, and you could obviously change that for your system, right? You kind of use the five Chinese elements: air, earth, metal, water, and wood.
You could do that. Or there's also like Legend of the Five Rings, where it's fire, water, air, earth, and something called void.
Okay.
Absence. Like nothingness. Yeah. Absence, yeah.
And actually, there was a fifth one with the Golden Dawn as well, and that was light. Well, I suppose the Neophyte, the first level, was the light that shines from darkness. So you could do that.
Yeah. I was just saying, like, I like Lyle's idea where maybe you wouldn't have to go through it in that progression, right? Level one, level two, level three, level four, you know? You just say, okay, I'm going to learn a little bit of... Actually, this is exactly what they did in Mage, isn't it? I'm going to learn a little bit of sort of this circle, and then I'm going to learn a little bit of that circle, and that's going to allow me to sort of put them together and do something different, because that's exactly what they do in Mage.
Yeah, actually, the Order of Dracul does something similar as well.
But you can also mix the actions required, because like there was a theurgy where you had to make contracts with demons and angels and whatnot, versus alchemy where you had to mix different chemicals together. So you could really have fun trying to put together exactly what your ritual is doing.
But I don't think that's a bad thing, Wayne. You know, it's just a resource that people can go to.
Good point.
To give them ideas. And I think like after Mage came out, White Wolf thought, all right, you know, there's some things that are good with the system, things that are bad. But we definitely want to keep this, you know, let's combine powers to make these rotes. And then it became like even vampires could combine different disciplines to make these rotes. And if you have something, I mean, there's a lot of more open magic systems out there where you could build something along those lines. And there are, well, on the one hand, it's very open, where you're kind of just taking these threads to make your own fabric. Or then you have something that's kind of like pre-made.
Mm-hmm.
And those are like your scrolls or your rituals or maybe they're just easier to cast or whatever, or we can't figure out how to weave these threads together to make this spell, so we need to steal it from this other order. And that could be some of the big secrets that the orders keep from each other, is the ability to weave certain things together to these effects.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned spells, because I could almost see like the purpose for some of these orders in a fantasy world would be the creation of magic items.
Oh, yeah.
You have the different...
Well, mine was metaphorical threads, but...
Oh, yeah.
But it could be real threads.
Yeah, as you mentioned.
Yeah, and that has a history, or that's a basis in real history. The Golden Dawn were very big into talismans and such, and that they took from the Egyptian mythology.
Yeah, I could see different orders sort of specializing in different things. Like over here, you got your talisman makers, and over here, you got your scroll makers. Over there, you got your magic weapon makers.
Yeah.
Wouldn't be very secret that way.
You could have it where the more powerful organizations are the ones that don't have these trappings. Or maybe an organization actually props up something like the Golden Dawn as almost like a farce. You ever hear of the theory of the ninja?
Which is?
But they didn't actually wear the black costumes. Because is there anything more conspicuous than a guy in a black costume wandering around your castle? And you're like, geez, I wonder if he belongs. Whereas actually the ninjas probably would have dressed like a servant who would have been effectively invisible to the nobility. I think one of the theories of where the black costume came in is like in Kabuki. But the stagehands, they would wear black costumes to indicate that they're not there. So if they wanted to show that there was a ninja, they put him in a black costume because that was the best way to indicate you're not there. Mm. And that's where we kind of got the idea that they wear black pajamas. So another idea put forth is these guys were a distraction, is the guy throwing these shurikens around, which they said was not very effective, and had these like strange weapons, and everybody's like, oh, what is that? And then the real ninjas would actually go and do the job.
Isn't it in Legend of the Five Rings where it's something like the Scorpion Clan, they have to spend like a year in those black ninja pajamas using the ridiculous weapons, and then if they survive, that means they're good enough to become one of those regular clothes wearing invisible ninjas?
Yeah. Actually, the Scorpion Clan and that Scorpion book, if you can get a hold of that from the first edition, is a great read. Yeah. And that links to Golden Dawn.
because they're all ninjas.
No, because the Golden Dawn is actually just there. Like, people kind of buy into that there's magic in the world, but everything's fake. Mm-hmm. It is what it actually was. It's just a fake secret society that offered you nothing. But there's actually a real secret society that has the real magic, and they kind of say, well, you know, they've gone through the progression, that person's showing talent, and they pluck them out of there. But nobody can see the real secret society because they're too distracted by all these like open secret societies, like the Freemasons and guys like Aleister Crowley, and everybody's like up in arms about him. But then the real mages and that can do their thing.
Yeah, and that'd make perfect sense as to why they have such a high level of secrecy about it. Because if someone can progress through all these different levels of the Golden Dawn maintaining these stupid secrets, then they might be able to actually handle real secrets when they get to there.
Yeah, it is a true initiation. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Again, it gets a little bit kind of like mage, but I could see that in like a D&D world where it's like, no, the wizard class is someone who's actually in that real secret society. And yeah, you're a powerful spellcaster, but the trick is you have to make it look like you're not really using magic.
No, that'd be good. It's like, what if you have a society where, people maybe don't believe in magic, or magic is outlawed or whatever, so you've got to be a secret. All right, well, just like the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn, we kind of... went everywhere.
Splinter groups,
yeah. But we always go back to World of Darkness. But yeah, this was our hopefully first in a series on magic. And what we'll do is try to pick like real world examples. And of course, as you can tell, magic's not real, but what people thought, were real, and see what we can do with those.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us on a very magical episode of Idle Red Hands. You can check us out online at www.idleredhands.com, idleredhands.com. Listen to the episode right there on the website or through Stitcher, or download the episode through DriveThruRPG. We also stream through iTunes. Check us out with Facebook posts, Twitter. We have a forum where you can post, and you can post right there on the website on our episodes, or even send us an email, because we love hearing from you guys. And yeah, we'll see you next time.
Bye.
See you.
Bye.
DriveThruRPG. We average 9 new titles a day. That's over 60 a week. And we've got well over 15,000 RPG titles online right now. DriveThruRPG, the one true source for RPGs.
Kobe, Japan. See us online at www.idleredhands.com. Music provided by Tripod Jimmy, and the song was Roadkill. Hope you enjoyed it. See you next time.